progress is as open here, more so indeed, and as satisfying in reward as any success on the earth plane. One has only to have a glimpse of the planes of mind, where emotions have been conquered and transmuted into aspiration, to realize the wonder of creation and the love of God for his creatures. One has only to see the dark misery of the self, imprisonment of souls in the shadow, worlds to understand the justice and the balance of the life force. When telepathy and mind, communication become more widespread in the world, then will light be raised up in man and he will realize his oneness with all. Then will the meaning of peace on earth, goodwill to men, become apparent. Then will the veil of darkness, the belief in matter, begin to dissipate and the thought force of man be lifted into constructive manifestation. Then will man graduate from the shadows towards the light, from misery to joy, from ignorance to knowledge, from illusion to reality. And then will the world know peace. Let light descend on earth. 17 February. Let me tell you about Jeannie. Jeannie lived to be nearly 12 years old on earth. She was a pretty, fairy-like child, daintily made. Her whole ambition was to become a dancer and she began to train when she was very young, showing, I believe, a fair talent. Unfortunately at the age of 8 she contracted polio, a very severe case, and was, for some months, kept in an iron lung. She recovered but one leg was shrunken, it continued to shrink, the muscles appearing to be withering away. The poor child was in and out of hospitals for months. She underwent several operations, she wore a brace on her leg, but the muscles continued to shrink until one leg was noticeably shorter than the other. She was often in much pain, but the greatest sadness to this child was in the loss of her dancing life. She couldn't bear to think that she would never dance again, never be in the corps de ballet, never have the happiness of performing what she loved to do. In the hope of having the leg restored to normal state, she stoically underwent the several tortures of stretching tackles, iron clamps and further operations. In the end, and at the age of 11 years, she knew that she would never be as other girls, she would never hop, or jump, or run again. The agony to her mind and emotions of this realization and the constant bouts of illness weakened her constitution. At 12 years old, after a chill, she died of pneumonia. When Jeannie woke up here in our home, Mother Florence and I were at her bedside. The child looked about her, trying to focus her sight on these new surroundings. At last she saw us, stared hard, then her little face crumpled and she burst into tears. "It's the sister. I'm back in the hospital again," she wept. "Please, please don't make me have any more operations." Mother Florence patted her hand. "You are only in our home for a rest," she said. "You're going to be quite well again, Jeannie." "Quite, quite," she emphasized the word "well." The child looked at Mother Florence. "Are you the matron?" she asked. Mother nodded. "If you like to call me that. But this is not a hospital, only a rest home, and you are getting well very quickly." Jeannie turned her head away. "No," she said, "I'll never be well. I've got a shrunken leg." "Not now, Jeannie," I volunteered, "not anymore. Your leg is well, quite well and strong." The child shook her head. "Look at it yourself," Mother urged. "It's just as long as the other one. Take a look and see." "But I know it isn't," Jeannie couldn't be persuaded. "I know you're only saying that. Where's my mummy?" "You can go and see her presently," Mother suggested, "when you've learned to run again." "Run?" Jeannie's attention was caught. "Yes, run." I bent over her. "We're going to teach you to run and play and dance here, Jeannie." Her eyes brightened. "Dance?" "Yes, dance." I took hold of her legs, gently raising them. "Look, Jeannie, they're both the same length, see?" Jeannie stared. She looked from one to the other of us. Slowly she sat up. She ran her hands up and down her calves, over the ankles, fingering the bones of the feet carefully and then back to the knees. She did this over and over as if she couldn't believe that which she could feel and see. She was silent, puzzled. It evidently never occurred to her to try to stand up. Habit was still too strong. She just sat there holding her legs and gazing down at her feet. Presently she looked up at us. "Is it a miracle?" she asked in an awed voice. "You could call it a miracle," Mother answered, and the smile that illumined her face was truly beautiful. Jeannie was silent, considering this. "Are you the Virgin Mary?" she asked at last. "No, I'm not the Virgin Mary, dear. You look like her, and I too thought how lovely was the face beneath the plain veil, and she does miracles." Mother smiled. "Supposing you get up and stand," she suggested. "Without my crutches?" "Yes." "Dry." "Will it hurt?" "No." "You won't have any pain. You'll never have that old pain again, Jeannie. You promise?"
"I really won't."
Suddenly Jeannie caught my hand and clung to it. "I promise," we both said. She nodded. It was plain that she was not sure that she could trust us.
"Won't you try to stand?" asked Mother again.
She did not make an answer, but she allowed me to lift her legs and set them down. We held her little body and slowly we raised her to her feet. She staggered and swayed, terrified to put any faith in the once crippled leg. After waiting, she put down her foot, but still clutched at our support. Slowly her expression changed. Surprise, incredulity, belief, joy, spread over her face. She let go of us. She stood erect, balancing on both feet. She even moved forward a few paces.
"It's true. It's true. It is a miracle."
Suddenly, overcome with this great and joyful awakening, she sank back onto the bed and she sobbed for pure happiness.
"I shall walk again," she cried. "I'm well. I'm like other girls."
Her eyes clouded, she looked piteously at me. "Unless I'm dreaming."
"You are well, Jeannie," I insisted, "and it isn't a dream. It's true."
She smiled. It was obvious that this had all been a great strain for her. She was becoming weary. She would need rest. One's first return to consciousness after one's transition is often overwhelming, and this was no exception.
"Then if this is true, we must say a prayer. A thanks.
A Hail Mary." Mother Florence bent over the child.
"Would you like us all to thank God with you?"
she asked gently. The girl nodded. She closed her eyes. Together we spoke softly the prayer of thanksgiving. As we prayed, Jeannie slipped back into the passive state of the newly awakened into this consciousness. So we let her rest. Jeannie was my constant companion. We went for long walks together. We vied with each other in finding the most beautiful flowers. We ran hand in hand down the long slopes of the hills, and it was a joy to watch the child. She danced and whirled and twirled about as lightly as a butterfly. She ran from flowers to flowers. She skipped and sang and laughed for pure joy. I have discovered that she has a well-developed mind. Perhaps the years of sickness, the enforced rests, and the consequent periods of reading and thinking have developed a deeper stratum of thought than was usual in children of her age. She has a philosophical bent and a wisdom that is surprising in one so young.
Did I say young?
Her soul is not young, she is, I should judge, an advanced soul. She seems to know so much, without even having been told. I recall her manner of accepting death, naturally and solemnly. Nobody had actually said anything of this transition. She was allowed to rest until ready to move. Then she walked about the grounds of this beautiful home to her heart's content. She was carefully shielded, of course, from our sick patients. I came upon her in my garden.
"Do you want to see my flowers?" I asked.
She shook her head. "I've come to see you, sister." There was a pause. Her eyes regarded me with direct candor. "I've just realized something." I waited. "I've realized that I'm not dreaming," she said quietly. "I'm dead." Her gaze held mine.
"We're all dead."
"That's true, isn't it?"
"Yes, it's true, Jeannie," I answered her, "but you see, we're really more alive than ever.
You've only got rid of your sick old body and found a new one." She accepted this.
"I suppose this is a sort of heaven."
"It's the beginning of heaven, Jeannie."
"You mean we're only starting?"
"We're not there yet."
"Not in the heaven you mean, Jeannie.
But we're on our way there." She digested this. "But it's so beautiful here. Everyone's so kind and..."
and angelic. We're certainly not angels. I retorted, and we both laughed at that. She was quiet suddenly. Then where's God? She demanded. Much too far away for us even to see him. We're not ready for his glory yet. But we're all going forwards, on towards his heaven.
You mean, his heaven could be better than this?
Oh, much, much better. Far more beautiful and full of light, and angels, angels of light. She smiled at me. We were both silent whilst she thought this out. I see, she agreed. Her face lit up.
I like that. Angels of light.
At another outing, she said, quite suddenly. I hope Mummy won't miss me terribly.
I don't think she will. You see, I was always ill, and then there are the others. Mummy was always so busy.
You had brothers and sisters?
Yes. They weren't like me.
They were well. She considered gravely for a moment. I'd like to talk to Mummy though.
Can I?
We can try, Jeannie, but it isn't easy to reach your mother. You see, those who can hear us on Earth must have developed an inner telephone. I don't think Mummy had an inner telephone.
We had a telephone, of course, an ordinary one, and I liked talking into it.
For a while we both watched a shaft of light that seemed to glow beyond where we sat.
I'd like to see Mummy again.
And see what she's doing.
Can I?
We can try, I answered, recalling my own experiences at the memorial services.
You tell me what your mother is like and your house and your brothers and sisters, and I'll see if we can make a picture.
And we can go down through the picture,
is that it?
She had caught on quickly to this new game.
Yes, that's it.
We tried. She described her mother, her father, her family, her home on Earth. I did my best to concentrate and to project us into the picture. We were silent for so long that I wondered if indeed Jeannie had found her people. She lay on the grass beside me, her face very rapt and expectant. At last she sighed. I can't see Mummy. But I feel that I'm near her. I think she knows. I'm trying to tell her that my legs are both the same length and that I can walk and run now.
Oh, I want her to know that, sister.
Do you think she does?
I'm sure she has an inner feeling about it, Jeannie.
Mummy isn't unhappy about me.
Not really, the child went on. I feel that she knows I'm in heaven and she's glad about that.
I am really, aren't I?
What could I answer?
Darling, you are very near heaven, I said. I was thankful that this explanation had been put into my consciousness.
I suppose this is life everlasting?
She persisted. I had to think out my reply. We have always been in life everlasting, Jeannie, even when we were on Earth.
Our souls, our true selves, always have lived from experience to experience.
This is only another part of experience.
She took this very seriously.
And heaven will be another experience?
There will be many experiences, I believe, my dear, even before we reach heaven.
You mean where God is?
I nodded.
Yes, that must be a most glorious sphere.
Presently she said, I never went to church or Sunday school much.
I couldn't, of course, and my parents weren't very religious. But the nuns in the hospitals used to talk to me. They told me stories about Jesus and the saints.
You believe in the saints, don't you, sister?
Of course. They are the wise ones, the great ones, and they have communion with the angelic host.
Do you think I shall ever see them?
I was moved to say a blessing on this sweet, innocent soul.
Yes. You'll see them, Jeannie, and the angelic host.
The angels of light?
I nodded.
And the angelic host,
I agreed.
Very likely before I shall, I thought to myself, she said quietly.
I hope I do.
You see, in hospital, I used to ask little sister threes to make my leg grow to the same length as the other one.
I'm sure she heard me.
Perhaps, sometime, I'll see her.
Really see her, perhaps, I said.
I clearly remember her visit to my garden not long before she left us.
Then she burst out, Mother Florence says when I'm ready I'll go to the halls of beauty.
That's in another part of heaven. She says I'll see the greatest dancers in all the world there,
Greek dancers, Indian dancers, Pavlova and Nijinsky, and oh, heaps of others. She says I'll learn to dance, really learn I mean, and that I'll be able to join with these others in the great dance festivals. Do you believe that, sister? Mother Florence knows much more about the spheres than I do. I agreed. She pirouetted up and down on her toes before my flower bed. Oh, it will be lovely. I'll work so hard and I'll be good. I do mean to be ready soon. Of course, I'll miss you and Sister Hilda and Mother Florence and everybody, but I want to go so much. I must go soon. You see, she stopped dancing, quietened and stood still before me. You see, I've got to be perfect at dancing before. She broke off. Before what, dear? She swung herself round so that I couldn't look at her face. Before I go back to the earth again. Really to be a dancer. For a while I was silenced, overwhelmed by the wisdom of this child. Who told you that you would return to earth? I asked at length. She still averted her face. It was the angel, she told me. He came when I was resting. And he told me. She returned and regarded me solemnly. You know, I think he was my angel. I seemed to have known him before. What was the to answer to this? Out of the mouth of this babe, I, who had vowed myself to the religious life, was being given the answers. I felt very humble indeed. Jeannie recovered very quickly from the strangeness of her transition. She adjusted to this new life with all the flexibility of a child's unspoiled nature. To her everything was a revelation. I shall ever think of her as a happy, dancing soul. One of the band of beauty in God's plan. She left us very quietly. One moment she was there, laughing, dancing, chattering amongst us all. Then we became aware of a being standing beyond the shade of the trees, a man of light, tall, graceful with the beautiful limbs of a dancer. He stood in the light and he held out his hand. Come, Jeannie, he said. She ran to him immediately. Then she turned. Her little face was transfigured with joy. It's the messenger, she cried. Isn't it wonderful? Wonderful. She waved to us all. Thank you for what you have done for me. Thank you for helping me get well. Now I shall really dance. You will come to the beautiful place to see me sometime, won't you? Won't you? She put her hand with perfect trust into the hand of the messenger. Goodbye. Farewell for a space, we called back. Together the two walked down the long sunlit slopes, and the light of the messenger seemed even brighter than the light shimmering over our gardens. Then they were gone. And I, for one, felt that we had given back a ray of sunshine to the great creative Sunday I miss Jeannie, of course. That child, by the fine quality of her nature, had taught me much. Beauty as such, in the creative arts of dancing and movement, had been absent from my earth life altogether. Now I realized how much I had missed, for beauty is surely an attribute of God. And the art of the dance is a manifestation of that attribute. I hope that I shall see Jeannie in her Hall of Beauty festivals sometime. It will be a great and moving moment. 17th February, continued. When I was in the community I spent some periods on missionary work in the hinterlands of South Africa. I remember telling you about my journeys out over the rough roads, of our old jogging mule and the funny little but in which I was housed for my visits. Well, I have, with Mother Florence's permission, been allowed to accompany her and some of the sisters on their missionary work into the shadow lands. It is a salutary experience. I am specially being instructed to recount the sad adventure to you, that it might be included in the book. For it might be of use in clarifying the illusory ideas on the states of heaven and hell which have been fostered through the centuries. There are heavens. I myself can vouch for the little heaven of beauty, tranquility and loving service which it has been my happy lot to contract here. But there are spheres of unimaginable joy and beauty beyond. Building up and extending out of every state of development. Right on, I believe, to the spiritual worlds of divine thought, far beyond any conception you and I can have of them. Such is the progress of the soul towards these spheres of perfection, and it is assuring to realize that we have all eternity in which to journey onwards and upwards. But there are also hells, though certainly differing from the physical hells and everlasting fiery torments of man's warped imagination. There are hells of the spirit and the mind, confining states of misery, dark, depressing and as real as the tortured consciousness of the dweller therein makes them. Yet these hells are not eternal. The man, or woman, in these mental torments need stay there no longer than his desires keep him. He is free to resist the hatreds, cruelties, lusts of his lower nature which he has retained from his earth life and which are keeping him in dark dungeons amid like minded inhabitants. He can always choose to follow the light of love, forgiveness and harmony, and always there are souls ready to help, to guide, to comfort and to assist. No soul is ever left comfortless unless he wishes it. That sounds like a paradox, but then much that we learn here is very different from the teachings of man, even good men who are limited in their ideas. Existence on earth is a state of living in a thought world, illusory, and much restricted and enclosed by the glamorous web of matter. Beyond physical death, the thought world is more apparent and certainly far more potent in its effects. Cause and effect is still the law on this plane of astral matter, as it is on earth. I understand that only as the soul proceeds onward in its progress into higher realms can this law be superseded, and then other and higher laws must be obeyed. But to my mission. Mother Florence, two other sisters and I, made our journey into what you would call the underworld. Here we prefer the description Shadow Land, for this is indeed a land of shadows. The journey to this place is difficult and wearying, for we have, by concentrated thought power, to slow down our vibrations so that our bodies will be enabled to endure physical conditions pertaining therein. The sisters never go without the special messengers who guide them there and conduct them to the various stations on the way. The Shadow Land is a very real place indeed. A gloomy murk covers it, to which one has to become accustomed, squalid dwellings inhabited by unhappy, tormented beings who jeer and mock and pursue their warped existences. Sometimes these poor souls live in hatred and rebellion, sometimes in apathy and sometimes with a fierce denial that there is any other state of existence possible. But I must tell you of the painter whom I met, an artist who lives in a dreary little room in a dark and crooked street in Shadowland, yet who still cherished in his soul some remembrances of beauty. He was, on earth, a Frenchman, a painter of promise, who dissipated the gift which God had entrusted him. He spent his life in riotous laziness, indulging in drink and drugs, until he was reduced to the gutter. Eventually he was mixed up in a night brawl, during which he killed a fellow artist, and himself received a knife wound from which he later died. I must have become separated from the others of our little band, for I found myself alone in this narrow street with its uneven cobbles and narrow pavements between the dwellings. Seated before an easel at the curb edge was the painter. He was splashing greasy oil colors onto his canvas. He was short and squat, with a mass of dark hair which bunched untidily about his face, and he appeared to be wearing a dirty gray overall. As I stopped to view his work, he looked up and scowled at me. The painting, I observed, was dull and uninspired. It consisted of great shapeless masses which I concluded were meant to represent his fellow beings. They looked dreary enough in all conscience, and all in unrelieved somber hues. When he took no notice of me, I asked, "Is this your studio? May I be allowed to see your other canvases?" He scowled again, but he jerked his head towards the open door nearby in a gesture which I took to be of assent. I went into the cluttered room. It was a dark little hovel of a place with only one window, and that too dirty to admit anything but a faint twilight. The walls were stacked with canvases. At first I was so nauseated by the strong penetrating smell of the room that I was unable to do anything. When, however, I became used to the odors, I was able to give my attention to the paintings. I began to examine them closely. They were all the same, all dark, all hideous, all primitive and almost evil in their sardonically clever interpretation of character, and all exceedingly ugly. But there was one strange feature common to all of them. A door. Painted into the background of each picture there was always a door, dark brown in color, and always closed. The door was always of the same pattern, and of the same mahogany tone, but always there was a faint line of white outlining it. This effect had been attained by leaving a wisp of white canvas exposed. I studied the paintings with great care and was immediately interested from a psychological point of view, for the door was always represented, its dark panels closing away a suggestion of light. After a little I became aware that the painter was standing at my elbow. "Well," he growled, and if he spoke in his native tongue I understood perfectly in mine, "so you don't like them. They're too gloomy," I said. He waved his arms wildly. "Too gloomy? I defy anyone to do any other in this stinking hole. Why do you stay here then?" He glared. "Oh, drop dead. Why do I stay? Do you think I would if I knew a way out?" I turned as if to leave. "There is a way out," I remarked, casually. He kicked viciously at a canvas. "Same old missionary stuff. I've heard it all before. A lot of blasted prejudiced saviors. And you're all living in illusion, same as me." The strange answer indicated a mind not wholly obliterated. "I'm neither blasted nor prejudiced." I kept my voice as cool as thought could make it. "That seems to be a description of yourself." He was most affronted. "What the hell? You are blasted, living in this place," I pointed out. "I should imagine anyone would be, and you are prejudiced because you've closed your mind to anything else." "Anything else?" he roared. Suddenly, with a change of tone, as he swung round to face me. "And is there anything else?" "Yes," I said confidently, "there is." "Tell me," he jeered. This was not going to be easy. "There are places here," I felt my way carefully into what I wanted to impress on him, "where painters like yourself live and paint the natural beauties of the countryside." "Ah." His temper had modified a little. "So it is the old, old story. I've been told it all before, you know." I nodded. "Nevertheless, you still hold to your prejudices? You won't believe, even if you keep on being told." "How can I?" He glared about him, snatched up a canvas, crumpled it and threw it into a corner. "I ask you, how can I? I've been in hell too long. Yes, too long." I dared to interrupt. "Perhaps I've become accustomed to it. It's been a hell of a long time. They brought me here from the hospital. Though I haven't yet worked out what happened to me. I was unconscious, I think. And then I found myself here. Nobody seems to know why. And anyway, I wouldn't ask the old sots, they don't know anything here. Nor care to find out. I keep myself to myself." He gave me a wicked grin. "I'm not the type, lady, for confessions and that sort of thing." "Then what are you doing but confessing your prejudices and fears to me?" "Bah. You're making your own hell, you know." He swept out his arm in an eloquent gesture. "I never made this. Not actually, only by your thoughts you have. Just as the others have done." "The others here? Blasted crows. Haven't an idea in their heads. They don't even know the differences between light and shade. And do you?" I pointed deliberately to the masses of dingy color in his picture. His temper rose at once. "Yes, I do," he roared. He stalked across the room, back to his easel, glared at the half finished canvas on it. "Damn your eyes. I could paint once. I did paint, I tell you, really paint. But not now." Suddenly he was quiet, anger spent. "Could you paint here?" he whispered. I glanced at the mediocre dwellings in the street, the contorted faces of the individuals who passed by outside, the dirt, the squalor. "I wouldn't dry." "Ah. Why don't you try to find other places?" I suggested, as he did not speak. "Other places? Where it is light and beautiful." He watched my face as he pondered this. "You know such places?" "I know them." He shrugged. "Me? How could I get to them? I have nothing, no money, no pass, no tickets. How could I ever get to such places?" I was about to reply when I became conscious of Mother Florence standing beside us. I had been so absorbed that I had forgotten the others with whom I had made the journey to these hells of thought. "By looking for them," Mother Florence interposed very gently. "By asking to be taken to the places of light." He stared at her. Disbelief, distrust stood out around him like a dark cloud. "You're sure there are such places?" he demanded, but now there was a harsh expectancy in his manner. "Oh, yes.